Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, I'm Veronica Skiersbrig, happy to be back with you once again. Welcome to today's broadcast. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you two features. One, an interview with a Catholic priest from Germany who works at the Center for Dialogue and Prayer located in the neighborhoods of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And the other, a conversation with an award-winning Polish cosmologist focusing on science and faith in our day and age. All the while, I'll be bringing you Pope Benedict's words relating to these two features. Well, thanks for joining me once again. On Wednesday, 28th of January, following his customary general audience with pilgrims from across the world, Benedict XVI renewed his full and unquestionable solidarity with the world's Jews, condemning all ignorance, denial, and downplaying of the brutal slaughter of millions of Jewish people during the Holocaust. On this occasion, the Pope also recalled his many visits to Auschwitz.
Ritornano alla memoria le immagini raccolte nelle ripetute visite mie ad Auschwitz.
Highlighting how the Holocaust should teach all generations that only the arduous path of listening, dialogue, love and forgiveness,
che solo il faticoso cammino dell'ascolto e del dialogo, dell'amore e del perdono,
leads the world's peoples, cultures and religions to the hoped-for goal of fraternity and peace in truth.
E della pace nella verità.
After this summary of the Pope's words on Wednesday, as announced earlier, it's time for me to introduce you to Father Manfred Deselers, a Catholic priest who was born in Germany in 1955, 10 years then after the end of the Second World War. He's a man who, after his ordination to the priesthood back in 1983, has played an active role in Christian-Jewish dialogue. In 1990, he moved to Poland, where he now works at the German, Polish and Christian-Jewish Reconciliation Center for Dialogue and Prayer in the neighborhood of the concentration and extermination camps of Auschwitz-Birkenau. I met him in this bleak place back in May 2006, on the occasion of the historic visit to these camps of Benedict XVI, a fellow German. I myself was in Poland to report on this papal visit for the radio, and I have to admit the encounter with Father Manfred proved to be one of the most moving moments of my week there. He's a gentle and charismatic man who's made it his mission in life to work towards reconciliation through dialogue and prayer. Something he does on one of the scenes of the largest experiment in genocide in the history of humankind. In a few moments, I'll be sharing with you an interview I did with him on that occasion, and which I have never aired in its entirety. I've chosen to do this for two reasons. The first, to mark the International Day of Commemoration of the Victims of the Holocaust, which falls each year on the 27th of January, a date which coincides with that day back in 1945, when the inmates of the concentration and extermination camps of Auschwitz-Birkenau, those who still could, walked to freedom. But the second reason is to mark the current International Year of Reconciliation sponsored by the United Nations. I thought it would be a fitting moment to highlight a man who has worked hard at the Reconciliation Center for Dialogue and Prayer for so many years. One who, as a matter of interest, in the year 2000, was awarded the title of Man of Reconciliation by the Polish Council of Christians and Jews. Father Manfred, can I ask you a very personal question? Why do you work here at Auschwitz?
It's hard to answer it shortly. In my biography, there were times When I touched the issue of Auschwitz, the first time it was after finishing high school, I decided to do civil service with an action service of peace in Germany, an organization which is engaged in reconciliation work after World War II. And with them I spent one and a half a year in Israel. And preparing to this time and work in Israel, we also were here in Auschwitz. This was in 73. Being here for the first time, I was very much moved and touched and, in a sense, shocked about what my people, the German people, has done. And I understood that being normal is not normal. And it means a great responsibility. A great responsibility for peace and reconciliation. 2 years later, I decided to study theology and become a priest, and the service for reconciliation for me still is one of the main issues.
You said you came here because of the shock you felt. I think what shocked me this morning, I saw Auschwitz for the first time, was the sheer scale of it and the systematic elimination that took place here. What struck you?
The scale and the scale of loss of feeling, of dignity, of person. People were treated as material. They were used as working labor, but they had no dignity, which was respected. Once I talked with a survivor, a Jewish person, and she asked me, what do you want me to do here? And I answered, in a sense, I want to give you back your dignity. And she said to me, oh, Manfred, you don't have to give me back my dignity. I did never lose it. You have lost it, which means, of course not personally, I lived not in that time, but those who were responsible for what happened here lost the conscience, the faith, the feeling of human dignity.
You spoke about those who were responsible, so you still feel a common guilt all these years later, 61 years have gone by as a German?
All the survivors say me, Manfred, you are not guilty, because I'm born many years later. I don't feel that all the Germans now living are guilty, but someone did what happened, and there is a guilt, and this is connected with the German people. And it's not possible to escape it, but it's changing into responsibility. I have to know what wounds have been caused in other people, in other nations, and they are still wounds. And this, for me, means a responsibility to try to build bridges, new bridges, to enforce existing bridges, which have to be human bridges, bridges from heart to heart, bridges of trust. I cannot be here just as a human person, not being seen as a human person from Germany. And this has a dimension of special responsibility.
You stress that word, responsibility, as someone who's born in Germany. Clearly, Benedict XVI comes here as Pope, but we can't ignore the fact that he too is German, no?
No, first of all, he comes here as a Pope. He is not representing the German people, he is representing the Catholic Church. But of course, it has a meaning that he is German, like it had a meaning that John Paul II was Polish. John Paul II was born here, not far from here. So when he came here from a very personal feeling of obligation, and also he had been bishop in this area. Benedict has a totally different background, but in this time of history, he said himself, maybe it's a sign of providence that after the Polish Pope, there's a German Pope. And coming here, he certainly shows that The memory of Auschwitz and the wound of Auschwitz is something important for the church, at least in this given time of history. And he feels he should come here to pray, to honor the victims, to show the world and his German people and the church that it is important to remember and important with this memory to do whatever we can for peace and understanding among nations and religions.
How does one pray in a place where so much evil has been perpetrated? I mean, where was God?
I think here you always begin with silence, not with words. With silence and listening. Listening to the voice of this earth, listening to the memories of the victims, and looking for God, searching God. For us Christians, the memory of Jesus on the cross with the cry, my God, why have you abandoned me, is very important. So it helps to believe that those who died here were not abandoned by God. But for me, it's in a sense easy to say so. I was not here in those times. But there are testimonies of those who survived, even of those who died here. Such testimonies of people losing their faith and testimonies of people who died with their faith, Christian and Jewish. For me, personally, the main important aspect is the memory, the belief that those who died here were loved by God. They had a dignity which God gave them, and the murderers could not take it in the end. So God was on their side and not on the murderer's side.
So Hitler didn't have the final word?
He did not. And I believe deeply that God has the last word, and God is love.
You were listening there to Father Manfred Deslers, a Catholic priest from Germany who works at the German, Polish and Christian Jewish Reconciliation Center for Dialogue and Prayer in the neighborhood of the concentration camps of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And now I'd like to move on in the broadcast on a totally different note by looking up to the skies. In 2009, in fact, the International Astronomical Union and UNESCO, the United Nations body that deals with education, science and culture, has called for a year especially dedicated to astronomy to mark four centuries since Galileo's celestial observations. This subject is one the Vatican is particularly interested in, given that, as you probably already know, it has one of the oldest astronomical research institutions in the world, an observatory once referred to as Specola. No surprise, then, that it is taking part in events to celebrate this year. In particular, on Thursday, at a press conference in the Vatican, its current director and astronomer and Jesuit, Father José Gabriel Funes, stressed how one of the goals of this year is to help the citizens of the world rediscover their place in the universe. He even remarked in English,
"We're all natural-born astronomers."
Well, after highlighting how we're all natural astronomers, Father Funes remarked how for centuries humankind has asked where we are and where we all come from. How through the observation of the sky, people can engage in a personal sense of wonder and discovery. But he added, a must to achieve this goal is the preservation and protection of dark skies. This time he said this in Italian.
Gli astronomi abbiamo bisogno dei cieli oscuri.
The search for dark skies are a natural obsession for astronomers. In fact, I may add, the Vatican Observatory may still be present in Castel Gandolfo in the hills south of Rome, but it moved there in the 1930s from the Vatican Gardens precisely to escape the glare of city lights. And indeed, since 1981, its main work has been carried out in Arizona, where the skies are even darker. But getting back to Father Funes, on Friday he also highlighted how this year, dedicated in a special way to astronomy, provides us with a great opportunity to communicate to the general public what we know and what we don't yet know about the universe. As a matter of interest, the resolution for this year was submitted by Italy, precisely to celebrate the first astronomical use of the telescope by Galileo. A landmark event in the history of astronomy, given how this discovery led to 4 centuries of astronomical discoveries. Suffice to think how today the telescopes that explore the universe 24 hours a day across all wavelengths of light no longer do so just from the ground, but from space as well. Astronomy is a topic Pope Benedict himself recently touched on. It was less than a month ahead of the opening ceremony of this International Year of Astronomy, which took place in Paris in mid-January. And what date did he choose? That of the winter solstice, the 21st of December, when in the Northern Hemisphere the days begin once again to lengthen. Just as the psalmist sang, "The heavens declare the glory of God, the sky proclaims its builder's crafts," he said on this occasion, so scientific discoveries and the laws of nature are a great stimulus to contemplate the works of the Lord with gratitude. For the record, as I'm sure you're aware of, the Catholic Church's stand as regards Galileo was once a hostile one. At the time of the invention of the telescope in the 17th century, the Catholic Church even accused Galileo as guilty of vehement suspicion of heresy for asserting that the earth revolved around the sun. Back in 1992, Pope John Paul II admitted to the fact that the Church had made a mistake in condemning the scientists' discoveries. More recently, Pope Benedict praised Galileo as a man of faith who saw nature as a book written by God. Now, among those scientists who saw God's hand in nature are various popes. To mention a few, Pope Sylvester II in the 10th century, who was himself a scientist. Pope Gregory XIII in the 16th century, who reformed the calendar with the help of a Jesuit astronomer. And Pope and a saint, Pius X, who designed sundials. Closer to us in time are many other Catholic scientists who are not necessarily popes. Benedict XVI highlighted their role on the Feast of the Epiphany this year, reminding us that in our day, thanks to the enthusiasm and faith of many scientists who follow in Galileo's footsteps and who renounce neither reason nor faith, it is possible to develop both in their reciprocal fruitfulness.
Grazie alla passione e alla fede di non pochi scienziati, i quali sulle orme di Galileo non rinunciano né alla ragione né alla fede, anzi le valorizzano entrambi fino in fondo.
One Catholic scientist who does exactly that and who found himself in the limelight this past year by winning the Templeton Prize for Science is a priest from Poland, Professor Michael Heller. He's a physicist and cosmologist I once met in the Vatican at the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. I was cheeky enough on this occasion to discuss with him matters relating to science and faith. I was aware that he'd worked for some time at the Vatican Observatory in Castel Gandolfo and was under the impression that he was an astronomer. It turned out I was wrong, but he quickly put me right, explaining how he was a professor of physics and philosophy. Although, he added, "You're not completely wrong, as I'm also a cosmologist, a branch of physics," he explained, "which is very close to astronomy." But let's get back to my talk with him, one during which my ignorance in scientific matters must have sorely tried his patience. I began by inquiring if science and faith could possibly go hand in hand. Just listen to his reply.
It's a very difficult question, science and God in general. This is the question people like asking, especially journalists. I think there are two extreme answers, I would say. The first answer is that science and God have nothing in common. And the other answer is, well, the other answer would be to give 5 hours lecture. But I shall try to be in between these extremes. Why I said science and God have nothing in common? Because science work on the presupposition that we should gain the results, the truth, if you prefer, only by means of our brain, nothing else. And God is something, well, which we must accept, say, by faith. So the methodological principles of science exclude, as it were, God from the very beginning. But this, of course, is a very simplified answer.
Can you explain that a little bit? Why is God excluded from the very beginning?
Because the methodology of science consists in looking for truth, in digging into the universe, only with the help of your intellect, without the help of revelation or of some philosophical beliefs. So you start only with what you see, what you can measure. Well, but this is only one side. Another side is that when doing science, you are not only a scientist, you must be a philosopher, especially if you reflect upon what you are doing in science. The questions arise like, why the universe is comprehensible? This was the old Einstein's question. He wanted to know why the universe is comprehensible. And Einstein said that you would probably never know the answer, because it's one of the greatest mysteries. Why it is an incomprehensible thing that the universe is comprehensible. I think that there is an answer to that, but it goes outside science. The universe is comprehensible because it is a product, if we can say so, of God's creation. And God, when creating the universe, had a rational plan. And the universe has been made according to this rational plan. And what science does is just extract or trying to decode this rational plan of creation from the universe. So this is a very complicated matter, as you can see. It was also Einstein's question. I want to know the mind of God when he created the universe. This is what science really does. It deciphers the plan which is hidden from the very beginning.
But science is the privilege of a happy few, no? Accessible to scientists only, in fact. So if that's so, how can one speak of people finding God in something they don't understand?
You know, science, it is a very strange thing. We are now Democrats, all of us. But science is not democratic. There are some people who know and who are able to know, who have special training and special ability, and there are some which are not trained or have no special ability. So there is no equality in science. And this is why it's so difficult to transmit something really true about science to the general public. General public wants a pill and everything contained in that pill. And this is what I'm trying to do now, is to say something more deep. To put the same thing I was saying just a moment ago in perhaps more simple terms, people would like to look for God in the results of science, and they cannot find him there. Because you should look for God at the fundamentals of science, in questions like why the universe exists, why it is comprehensible. And these are questions which lead to God, and which lead a little bit, which transcend science and its method.
Broadly speaking, the impression today perhaps is that, unlike in the past, when God was placed at the center of the universe, with the progress of science and technology, that is no longer the case.
That perhaps you are right in this, that in the past, the faith in God was perhaps easier than today for ordinary people. But this could be a kind of a very important but side effect of our development of our culture. Let's take a very, very simple example. People in the primary school have to learn multiplication table. But this knowledge now, especially in the countries which are more advanced, like in the United States, this knowledge slowly disappears. Young boys nowadays, they don't understand multiplication table. They simply know which button should be pressed on their pocket calculator. This is what happens with our culture. We have our technology. Science is reduced for the ordinary citizen just to pressing a button.
And not only.
But if you use your computer, you do not need to know what is inside.
Yeah.
Which the details of the program, the way the electrons go through silicon, you know, contraptions and so on. So you see only the surface of science. And we use in everyday life surface of science. It is surface of science which influences our culture. But scientists, like people who are gathered here in the academy, they are going deeper into the surface. And they know not only the multiplication table, but they know mathematical laws which govern not only computers, but the stars, galaxies, the beginning of the universe. And for those people, it is much easier than before to see, I would not say the God of religion, but some supreme being, some, I would say, brain, mind, which is behind that. For them, I think it is in general much easier than the ordinary people. Because in the eyes of modern science, if you not limit yourself to the surface, science presents the universe not as a great machine or a great computer, but rather as a great thought. And this is why science is a new quality in our culture. And it's a very great pity that it's closed to so many people.
We live in a hands-on culture where things need to be tangible and there's no place for the invisible. Doesn't that represent a danger?
It's a danger, but yes, this is something which I would call the temptation of touching, as you said. We would like to know something by touching it, which something which resists our senses, and then we know it exists. But this is exactly what happens in science. You cannot touch the solution of the differential equation, but it governs the universe. Well, I'm going to give you an example. If you have a great wall, concrete wall, you can destroy it with a bomb. If it does not work, you can use an atomic bomb and destroy the big wall. Well, but if you have an equation which has no solution and you would like to have this solution, bomb doesn't work. It has no solution forever. And this is a kind of reality in science we are facing every day. It is not tangible. You cannot touch it. But nevertheless, it's more real than a thing you can touch. And I think this is a good metaphor for describing the action of God in the world.
You were listening there to Professor Michael Heller, a Catholic priest from Poland, who won the Templeton Prize for Science back in 2008 for his work over the past 40 years. Years in which he developed sharply focused and strikingly original concepts on the origin and cause of the universe, often under intense governmental repression at the time of the communist regime. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org.
Laudator Jesus Christus.